Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Conversation in Veterinary Pathology, the ACVP podcast, brought to you by the American College of Veterinary Pathologists.
The purpose of this podcast is to bring the veterinary pathology community together, to bolster our connections and spread knowledge. Veterinary pathologists are out there changing the world.
So welcome to the podcast. I'm Dr. Hannah Atkins, and this is Dr. Carolyn Labriola.
Welcome.
Today's guest is Dr. Mara Varville, Assistant Professor of Clinical Pathology at the Washington State University College of Veterinary Medicine. Listen as we learn more about the clinical pathology program at Washington State and Dr. Varville's interest in speeding up diagnosis turnaround times in academic clinical pathology using digital slides. But before we dive in, don't forget to check out the American College of Veterinary Pathologists Advocacy and Policy Committee's Errors in Publications portal. It's a completely anonymous way to record published pathology errors and contribute to our scientific community's rigor and reproducibility in veterinary pathology. You don't have to be a member to submit an error. Go to www.acvp.org and click on the Errors in Publications banner at the top of the page. Now let's get to the conversation.
Thank you so much for sitting down with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I'm just going to jump right in and say congratulations, because less than a month ago, you obtained your PhD.
Yeah,
thank you. That's so impressive.
Thank you.
Going right from there to what you do here at Washington, does your program, or do you, have opinions on pathologists who have practiced in veterinary medicine before coming into their residency?
We really like it for our residents to have practiced. We feel it helps them to really communicate with the clinicians and really have a better understanding of what the clinicians are asking for and what they need from us. They don't need a bunch of technical jargon. They don't need us to give them really very, very specific things. A lot of times when we're talking with clinicians, we're like, okay, where are you going next? And we encourage that communication, and it helps them to feel comfortable reaching out to them and asking them, what do you need from me, before they actually can give them the report, especially if it's like a stat case or something that's really urgent. We have those conversations early, and knowing which questions to ask and knowing how to ask those questions comes into it. And so our residents that have practiced, which I think all of our residents at this point have done some sort of practice, it really helps move that conversation forward, and it helps them be more comfortable communicating with them.
So you worded that your program prefers, I believe, but do you have any requirements?
We don't have a requirement, and it is really candidate dependent. It definitely gives them ticks in their favor if they have that, but if we have a really qualified candidate that comes through, and I can think of a couple of my students, even my second year students, that are interested in clinical pathology, that I am looking forward to their applications coming through, whether it comes through right after vet school or whether it comes through after they've gotten some practice. So it's not a requirement for us, but it is something that I think helps.
What does that practice usually look like?
So our third year resident right now, she actually did an internship year. So rotating internship at a practice. We had our second year resident right now kind of went from vet school and worked in a small animal practice. And so right now that's kind of what it looks like for us. It could be either internship year, it could be just working in a practice for a couple of years or a year or whatever. I have had several people that have been in practice for 5 years or longer that are interested in getting into clinical pathology, that are reaching out to me and asking, what do they do? And that's where we kind of invite them to rounds, see what we do. All of our rounds are on Zoom, so it's easy for people to come. So we invite them to rounds. We kind of let them see what we do. We talk with them about it and encourage them to apply and kind of make those connections. But it just looks like whatever the resident looks like. But it's nice for them to have that experience and kind of have that confidence coming in as well.
Right, because you have such an intimate relationship with your submitting veterinarians. Mm-hmm. How do you teach any student that might have less of that experience or different from what you do to follow that track and be on a page where they can have those sorts of communications?
Yeah, and really it's just about encouraging them to reach out, to ask questions, to talk to them. And so I do a lot of, if we get a submission from an outside clinician. So it's not necessarily in hospital where we know them, we can walk down the hall and talk to them. If it's someone else, usually I'm saying, hey, why don't you give them a call? Let's find out. And on the flip side of that, I encourage my students when they have something that they're not sure of, whether it's my fourth year students or my second year students, I'm like, hey, stop by ClinPath, come talk to us. We have candy. We like talking to you. And so I try to encourage communication on both sides of things. And I think that kind of letting the students know that you're doctors, this is your patient, letting them take ownership of those cases, in addition to kind of coming and talking to us and like realizing that we're not terrifying people. None of the clinicians here are terrifying people, but kind of encouraging that communication on both ends kind of helps build that confidence, which I think is really important for our students. Kind of so much imposter syndrome going on that I think that we need to be reminding all of our students, whether they're residents or vet students or even undergraduate students or technicians, or that they can do this. They're trained to do this. We believe in them.
Do you find that having that tight communication helps the clinicians that you work with and those fourth year students to submit better samples?
Yes, absolutely. Often I'm telling them, like, I'll be like, hey, screen your samples, come talk to us about it. Or when you do a bone marrow, make sure you take a core biopsy as well as the aspirate. And I have noticed that kind of since that communication has opened up and being really kind of vocal about it, and even going, I remember one time I had a bone marrow sample from a resident and I went down to the hallway to find her. I was like, Dr. Handa, did you submit this bone marrow? And she was like, yes. And I was like, it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I need you to teach everybody else how to do this. And it's just kind of, you see their faces light up. And so you point out the positive as well as the kind of the growing points. And so I think that kind of helps a lot. And I've noticed better samples since then. And if we have someone that submits a sample that's not great, we're like, here, maybe this will help you. And how we do this. And usually they take our advice, which is nice.
For your residents, they have gone out and gotten experience, but that experience doesn't necessarily correlate with being able to write comments on a path report. You've talked about this whole relationship that you have with the clinicians. How do you help them get to a place where they can communicate with themselves a year ago as the clinician, now as the pathologist?
Yeah. And so when we're writing the reports, I always have to remind them that your description is where you describe what you saw. There's no interpretation. There's really no bias on that. You're just putting what you saw down on paper. Your interpretation, because we don't diagnose, we interpret. Your interpretation is kind of, this is what I think that this is showing. And then in your comments is really where you explain, this is what I mean by all of this. And here's the evidence of what I've described that tells me that this is more potentially like lymphoma rather than a reactive lymph node or something like that. And we do kind of encourage them to be like, okay, let's think about what you needed as a clinician. So especially on our outside cases, I encourage them to say, okay, we think we have a lymphoma. What's our next steps? Well, our next steps here are potentially submit a biopsy for histologic evaluation. Maybe we do some IHC. Maybe you submit a sample for flow. If it's kind of one of those waffly ones, maybe we submit for PAR. And so we talk about kind of what did you need to know as a clinician? If it's a mast cell tumor, maybe we recommend that they do additional screening. Look at the liver, look at the spleen, things like that. And so when we're talking about it, we kind of are talking about like, okay, what did you need? If we have someone coming straight out, a lot of times they feel like they need more than they did because they want all the things because they just came from a vet school that had all of the things.
And a referral setting where they can do a lot more.
Yes, exactly. And so a lot of times there, when you're talking to those students and those residents, they come out, you're talking about essentially like distilling down. Maybe we don't need all of these tests, but maybe let's pick the top three or pick the top two. And so I think that's helpful.
Right, especially once you go out into the real world and you do have to make those decisions based on budget or your availabilities or the amount of sample that you can get.
Yeah, exactly.
So we've talked about experience working in a veterinary clinical setting before residency. Do you or your program have opinions about a master's or PhD either before, during, or after residency?
I think that during the residency, especially if we have residents coming in that don't necessarily know which avenue they want to go down, I think it suits them better to do the master's because it opens more doors. more and more places and more academic institutions are really either requiring or requesting at least a master's. And so it's helpful for them to have that and to get it done while they're doing their residency. And it's not really more work for them, at least not in our program. We are actually in a very unique program where they're working on doing what's called a training certificate, and they're working on it, getting it so that actually our international students can do this training certificate, be part of the graduate school so that we don't have to worry about the visa issues as much because they're still part of the graduate school, but they don't come out of it with a master's. So we actually have the option for our domestic students and our international students to not do a master's. And if someone were to come in that either already had the degrees or they just came in knowing, I just want to work in a diagnostic lab, that's all I want to do, that would be a route that I would encourage for them. Our first year resident actually already has both a master's and a PhD, and we talked very seriously about whether or not she was just going to do the certificate training program versus the master's program. Ultimately, she is very research minded. And she did choose to do the master's program. And I think it actually came down to some visa, like small things with the visa rather than the program itself. But I do encourage that, especially with our students that they don't know. I want all of the doors open for them. I don't want them to potentially get to the end and be like, well, I want to do this, but I'm having a hard time finding a job because they wanted me to have this other advanced degree that I don't have. And so we kind of try to make it as easy as possible for them and to keep all of their doors open until the end.
Boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. What is the difference practically between mm-hmm. this training certificate and the master's?
Yeah, so the training certificate is more, the credits are more hospital associated. And so instead of having to take courses like immunology or research practice or things like that, you're actually spending more time in the hospital getting more essentially getting credits from time in the hospital. There's no requirement to do a research project. That being said, my resident that was considering it was already interested in a research project, so she was already going to be doing that. But so there wasn't a requirement. So we were going to be focusing her more on like case-based publications, things like that, versus the master's where you actually have like a regimen of classes that you take. Our students here do thesis masters, so they do have to do a project, a research project, and defend a thesis. And so that's something that's extra for our students. Generally, it's not going to be additional work. It's just going to be different work at the end of the day. So I think that either way, it's a good option. And I think that especially for our students that come in out of practice and our students that come in straight from vet school, giving them that kind of critical thinking training that comes from doing bench work and research becomes important because it helps those pathways in their brains kind of solidify a little bit more. And so they go and like they know how to essentially like follow, okay, I have a hypothesis, let's follow this down and how do I investigate this and what do I know? And that helps a lot when even they're working up cases. And so I like them to have that and I like to give them that opportunity as well. And the masters just make sure that they have it, essentially. Whereas the certificate program, we kind of have to get that in other ways.
But that does tie back to having that clinical experience is beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So then do you see a difference between any trainees that, or students or veterinary students mm-hmm. that did go do a master's or PhD and those who did clinical work before coming to residency?
I don't think I have enough experience to answer that right now. But what I can tell you is that I did not do any clinical experience or master's or PhD before my residency. I went straight from vet school into a residency. And I do feel like it took me a little bit longer to learn some of those things. And the master's at the program that I was at was actually a non-thesis master's. So it was case-based. It was publication-based. It was very similar to what the certificate program here the expectations were. There were a couple extra course requirements, but I didn't have to defend a thesis. I didn't have to have a resident project. And so continuing on to do my PhD was kind of where I got some of that extra benchwork training and extra kind of thought process on how do I work through these problems. And I think that kind of helped me solidify into the pathologist that I am, where I didn't have that as a resident. And so I kind of wasn't as confident as the resident. So
would you say that it was along your journey that you learned how to write these comments mm-hmm. as succinctly as possible?
Yeah, it took me a little bit longer. And I do know that my resident advisor had to do a lot of filtering. And one of his favorite things to accuse me of was Yoda speak, where I said things in a way that like seemed like instead of saying things just in a straightforward way, I tried to make it sound more, I don't know, professional or whatever. And that just wasn't what needed to happen. So I think that my advisors at Purdue had a lot more, had to spend a lot more time kind of training me on how to say things and what's relevant. And there were times where I would put a comment in and they come back and be like, what did this comment add? That was kind of something I had to continually ask myself. And that was an additional training that I had to have as someone who didn't really have that clinical experience going into the residency. And with that being said, when I finished the residency and was doing my PhD, I actually moonlighted as an ER doctor, which was terrifying as a pathologist. And I kind of learned some of that so that one later, as I was doing my PhD and filling in service, I was like, oh, this is the information they need, or this is what they're asking me for. Or this is where I need to spend my time focusing on the comments. And so I can say that did help make a difference. It just kind of came for me after the fact.
And it's great that you were able to adapt and now have that experience to teach the mm-hmm. trainees that you work with and your veterinary students as well. Mm-hmm. You've given us a glimpse into your teaching style and how you see your residency. What does a successful residency program look like to you?
So a successful residency program to me is a program that really spends a lot of time training their pathologists, but not just to pass boards, but to be able to really communicate with the clinicians, to be able to think about things in a way that is essentially meaningful for the clinicians. Boards essentially are just a test. It's not a measure of how good of a pathologist you are. And so I think it's an important test so that we can make sure that we're meeting our standards. But standardized tests don't do a good job of essentially how good of residents we're putting out. And so I feel like my goal as an educator for these residents is really to give them some level of confidence, to give them kind of the ability and the skills that they need to go in and see something, especially to see something that they've never seen before and they don't know what to do with. Maybe it's a sample from an oxalotl that you see this and you're like, what am I going to do with this? But to be able to pull the pieces together from things that they know, to be able to kind of make a meaningful interpretation of that. And then on top of that, to communicate that with the clinician that's actually submitting it. And I think we do a good job of that here. I hope we do a good job of it here. I've heard good things from our residents, so I'm going to keep doing what we're doing. And I want them to also be able to find a good work-life balance. I want them to stay being pathologists and really encourage as many as I can to stay in academia and help me train other pathologists. And so kind of getting them excited about what they're doing and keeping them excited about what they're doing in addition. So,
what goals do you consider as shared between different residency programs?
I think that we all kind of share the same goals of we want our residents to pass boards, but really we want to create this network of really knowledgeable pathologists that communicate with each other, that kind of understand that they may not know the answer, but here's the things that they can tell you and kind of the directions that they can lead you in to help you figure out the answer. And to be able to kind of communicate with one another, to communicate with clinicians, and to communicate with both students and then also the public as a whole. So we've got to kind of keep imparting those skills on them and also giving them the confidence, as I said before, for them to know that they're doing well.
How do you see the ACVP as being involved and then potentially bolstering those goals?
Yeah, so ACVP provides a lot of good insights. And I really love the presentations that come out like at the conference where it's like, here's what I thought I knew. Julie Webb is a member of ASVCP that does a lot of really good ones where she was like, here's all the times I was wrong. And they're really great presentations because it helps our residents see that it happens to everybody. And so I think the ACVP really, it encourages the communication between pathologists and kind of encourages them to be open about that. And they provide a lot of good information as well. So like, if you don't know what you're doing, you go to ACVP and you can go ask your network of pathologists at ACVP on whatever listserv is available, because we do that all the time. And so both ACVP and ASVCP do a good job with that. And then I also really appreciate their educational forums, like at the conferences and whatnot, because I always learn something new from these pathologists that have been out there teaching and helping residents for a lot longer than I have been.
You had mentioned outside submissions. What is the balance of your caseload between the veterinary teaching hospital and this outside submission?
Yeah, so we predominantly see cases that come straight from our veterinary teaching hospital. We see it's at least 75% of our cases, maybe 75, even 85, I would say. But we do see a low number, especially cytologies, of outside submissions. And that's really just coming from practices in the area. There's several clinics kind of from the greater Pacific Northwest area, even over in Montana, that we'll get fairly regular cases from, which is nice. And that's an area that we'd like to grow in and something that we're kind of working on of what can we offer to essentially the greater Pacific Northwest area. If anybody is listening that is interested in WSU as a clinical pathology service, we do provide outside cases.
What about any other neighboring states?
Definitely Idaho. We're very close to Idaho. So we get Idaho cases. We get some from Montana, mostly from Washington. And occasionally we'll get some from Oregon, just that kind of that top corner that's close to where we are. So we see them from a little bit of everywhere in this area. We have before gotten a case from California, but we'll take cases from anywhere. But the kind of shipping your sample to somewhere really far away is always a question. As far as if it's a cytology smear on a slide, that works well. If it's blood in a tube, that gets a little trickier.
How might you or your trainees handle writing a report, looking at a sample between what you're getting from the veterinary hospital and those outside?
That's actually a really good question. And that's something that we actually train our residents in, because in hospital, we know our clinicians well. We know what they know. We know what they want. We know what they need. And we can always go talk to them. Outside clinicians, we can't always do that with. Even if we call them, they're busy too. And so we can't just go and like find them. Usually what we train our residents to do is to put more comments on to kind of further explain essentially what they found in their report, maybe give a little additional information. And we always encourage those clinicians to call us if they have any questions. And sometimes they do. Sometimes our residents will field consulting questions where they'll have to pull up the reports and see. And it's interesting for them as well, because sometimes they're consulting on a case that they didn't read. And so they've got to know how to essentially extract the information from another report, because the resident that read the report isn't there that day and may not even be on service that week. And so in order to get the clinician the information they need, it might be something that they can talk them through, but they have to be able to read the report, see what their resident mate saw or the other pathologist saw, and be able to communicate that and help troubleshoot with the clinician. In some cases, it is a point where we will refer the clinician to be like, we're going to tell you, have the resident, the person who wrote this report, get in contact with you. But a lot of times what we're talking about is not, it's more troubleshooting. But just being able to pull up a report and have all the information that they needed in that specific report is really helpful. And so they kind of, when we're doing our outside cases, they train on that as well.
I'd like to ask you a bit more about your training. Mm-hmm. Are there teaching methods that you encountered during your education that you have adopted into your own teaching style?
Yeah, I think that the things that I've really been working on kind of adopting into, and some of them are the things that I hated in vet school. I hated the group work, the think, pair, share, and the we're going to put everybody into groups and do this flipped classroom thing. I did not like it. That being said, it works really well. And there's so much more engagement from students with that. And I have actually only gotten positive feedback from students with this. And so it's kind of a, maybe I was the odd one out that just didn't like talking to people, I guess. But so I actually put a lot more pauses and reflections in. And that's something that I really only learned the official terms for since I've been here at WSU. They have a really nice teaching academy that does a lot of presentations and kind of helps you essentially develop your teaching skills and try new things. And we have learning communities where we talk about these new things. And so pauses is the official term. And so that is something that where you put essentially reflection pauses into your lectures. And they can be various things. They can be a think, pair, share where you give them a question, the students think about it, they talk with their neighbor about it, and then you have a couple of them share with the group. You can also do other types of pauses where you ask a question using some sort of platform that's like an audience interaction platform, whether it's, we use Top Hat here. There's also Slido and, there's a whole host of them. I can't even think of another one right now. But where you essentially ask a question and they can kind of anonymously answer the question. And so you can get a feel for where you are in the lecture, if you need to go back to a subject or if you're doing okay. The students like interacting with each other. And for my fourth year students, that flipped classroom works really well. As much as I didn't like it, they really enjoy it. And so in my fourth year students, they get assigned cases. Here's your case. You're going to lead the discussion on this case. And I make sure that they go into it without feeling like they don't have the information they need. So I have them send me drafts where I tell them, and I tell them at the beginning, I'm like, I'm just going to look at this and tell you if you're off chasing unicorns and maybe guide you back to the more normal things. And so they'll send me a draft. I'm like, yep, you're on the right track, or maybe consider this. And then I found it super interesting because they will go and they lead this discussion. But every time they pick something within that case that they want to talk about even more in depth with their classmates and their colleagues, they do that on their own. And so they're essentially teaching their colleagues. Maybe it's more in depth on acid base. Maybe we're talking about like the causes of titrational metabolic acidosis or the causes of thrombocytopenia or something, but they go more in depth. And every time, and every student does this, and I don't ask them to, but they really get a lot out of it because they know that their classmates, the instructions are, everybody has to look at everybody's cases. You have to write up your case and you have to lead the discussion on your case. And so everybody has looked at the case and can give them feedback. And so they lead their colleagues through this case. And they'll ask questions and they'll get answers. And then sometimes they'll, even on their drafts that they send to me, they'll have questions. And I said, I don't know, let's ask the group. And so they'll ask the group and then they'll do a lot of self-teaching. And so I just kind of sit in the back and watch this all play out. And then if there's a question that someone can't answer, a lot of times I'll kind of either answer it then, or be like, you know what, let's look this up and we'll come back to this. And then kind of we do a little bit of training on how to look things up and what resources do we have and what's a good resource and what do we need to kind of double check on. And so they do a lot of really, really good things there. And this is also where I kind of put in the, we're not trying to get to answers. We're trying to get to what's your next best step, because we're thinking about this clinically. Does it matter right now if I know what is causing my patient's PCV of 12? Or do I need to transfuse this patient, sort of thing? And then we figure out what's causing it because this patient's not stable. And then we kind of talk about the really specific details of what are all the things that can cause it. What do we think is most likely? How do I figure out which one of those is most likely? And so that's kind of the direction that we go with that. And the students, they really like that flipped classroom. They really like being in charge. And some of them, you can tell that they're nervous. But kind of as the rotation goes on, they get more and more confident. And then they realize at the end, and I've done the evaluations where I've asked them, okay, at the beginning, how do we feel about this? Versus at the end, how do you feel about this now? And they're like, I feel so much more confident in being able to interpret this. I think I can do this now. I mean, our new group of students, fourth year students, now they're a lot more confident. And it's only been a couple of months, let alone those that are kind of about to be doctors and kind of have already been doing it in the clinic. I think it works really well, especially in that small group setting.
That's wonderful that you were able to take something from your veterinary school that you didn't like and now implement it not only in a way that you see is working, but in a way that you have evidence mm-hmm. is working. And that shows a lot of growth mm-hmm. and that you're really listening and becoming the educator mm-hmm. that is best for everyone.
We do a lot of evaluations after every rotation. And we tell them, we're like, there's the official evaluation where you essentially, like, that's what tells the university that I'm doing a good job. But I don't get those results in time. So fill out this other unofficial evaluation so you can tell me how to make this better for your next group of colleagues that come through. And so, and I think that they really appreciate that and kind of really appreciate that we're taking their thoughts into account, which I think goes over very well.
Do your residents have any involvement with the teaching?
Oh, absolutely. They actually have pretty heavy involvement, and we do try to tailor it a little bit to if they want, like how much of it do they want, but they teach in both our second year course. Our first year resident does two lectures in a lab. Usually we have them do our GI lectures and lead the GI liver lab. And then our third year resident is doing four lectures and two labs, I believe. But she's teaching white blood cells and then also acid base. We gave her the really hard subject. And she's leading the labs on both of those as well. We don't start them on teaching in the second year course until their second year of the residency so that they can kind of spend some time getting a feel for where they're at. Our ClinPath course for their second year starts in the fall, and so we don't necessarily want to just throw them into that while they're getting used to the residency and potentially taking some of their heaviest class loads. But they're also very involved in our fourth year teaching. The way our rotation works out, it's a 1 week rotation. And in the morning, so from 8 to noon, they spend it with our residents, and that is slide time. There's a presentation that will be done as far as on hematology, cytology, fluids, urine, whatever the topic of the day is. So they'll go through that presentation. There's individual time where the students will essentially get a microscope and look through cases on their own, and then they come together at the end and either do a multi-edit scope or eventually a digital slide. They spend all morning with them, and then in the afternoons in the rotation is when they spend it with the ClinPath faculty, where we will go over cases with them for the entire afternoon period.
With a teaching aspect, that's really great that you're able to give your trainees flexibility to show their strong points and teach to what works for them. With VetPath jobs available in comparative research, toxicologic pathology, and industry, does your institution tailor the program to provide practice in those areas?
Yeah, so it's interesting, and there's really kind of from an academic institution, and this is something that I talk about with my residents as far as what are their goals? Where do they want to end up? Because there's only so much I can do. I can't give them a diagnostic pathology experience here. I can't give them a tox path experience here. But what I can do is use those contacts that I've either made through ACVP or that ACVP provides and encourage them to apply for those internships or externships. I know that there's several good ones out there. For example, Charles Rivers has externships. And so I do encourage, and even my residents that have a pretty good idea of where they want to go, I encourage them to apply for some of those other externships and get that other experience. Another thing that we do, use my contacts judiciously. And that, so one of my resident mates works at Zoetis. We're friends. She comes to visit me. When she comes to visit me, I put her to work. And so she essentially gets to give a presentation. The next time she comes, it's going to be on digital pathology because that's just a well-timed thing and the difference between digital and glass cytology. But then she also gets some one-on-one time with the residents where they can ask her questions and they can talk to her about her career path, which was very different from mine. I mean, just being part of ACVP and being part of ASVCP, which is the ClinPath counterpart, you make those connections. And so using them well. And so if I've got a resident that is more interested in academia, great. I'm going to have her teach more or have him teach more. I'm going to have him spend more time doing some of those things. If I've got someone who's more interested in doing the research aspect of it, cool. I got research projects coming out my ears. I'm going to have them essentially take ownership of a project and run that, and then I'll be there to consult with them. But if I have someone who wants to go into ToxPath, which is very different in the clinical pathology world, because it's mostly chemistries, where in our world, we look at mostly cytologies, or if I have someone that wants to go work at a diagnostic company somewhere, and there's a lot of good options out there. And as far as what we can do on this end, we're going to work on training them so that they're more prepared to go into that field. We can train them on what does it look like to talk about ToxPath, because you're looking at different days essentially. And so how do you write up a report when you're talking about a progression over like day one, this is the chemistry. Day two, it's this. Day four, it's this. How do you put that together? Or if you're going into industry, what is the difference between glass cytology, which is what we have here, or digital cytology, which is something we're working on getting here so that we can train our residents in that. We're trying to give them a really well-rounded experience and encourage them to explore all of their options before they make a decision.
And how wonderful that our community is and is increasingly tight-knit so that you can help your trainees to get there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking about digital pathology, how do you see digital pathology affecting the current and future teaching atmosphere in residencies?
Oh, it definitely makes a big difference. And this is something that has been affecting my life dramatically for the last year, and that we were trying to bring in digital pathology here. And so to do that, we have to purchase a slide scanner, which my first step was I put it out on the ASVCP listserv. Hey, who's bought a slide scanner? What are you using? Like, let me know what your thoughts on it are. And I will tell you, the number of people that responded saying, hey, can you share this with us, was far more than the people that responded saying, hey, here's what we're using. And so the approach that we took for clinical pathology, it's a little different than anatomic pathology. Our needs are a little different. We need a little higher resolution. We need something that we can kind of see individual cells in. Which takes a little bit of a different scope. And so the scopes that work for anatomic pathology may or may not be the scopes that work for us. But yeah, so we looked at a couple of different companies, and we were looking at some different options that we knew were used at other institutions, things that were used in different diagnostic companies for clinical pathology specifically. And we had these companies come in and do demos for us. And from that, we picked one that we thought would work for our service size. It made a very big difference on the machine that we chose, because we didn't necessarily choose the machine with all the bells and whistles. We chose the one that was more realistic for what our residents would be experiencing out in practice. And with that, we're kind of working on putting those digital slides into not only our resident training, but also into our fourth year trainings. Slides break, and not all the boxes are full boxes anymore. And so having that as kind of our backup, so that students can look at the glass slides, but then we can all come together and look at a digital slide and maybe a better room or something with a better resolution camera or something like that. But one of the things that we're working on doing here, and I'm working with Laura White on it, we want to do joint rounds between the clinical pathology residents and the anatomic pathology residents, where we all put in cases, and these are going to be scan slides. And so they're going to have to evaluate the scan slides, likely write up a report of some sort on the scan slides, and then come together and discuss them. And so that's kind of looking at the differences between histopath and cytology, which is something that the opposite service could use a lot more of anyways, but kind of also to get digital training into especially our ClinPath side of things.
So are you mostly scanning at 100x?
No. We chose a system that scans at 40x. And it is one that is used by another company, but we essentially, it's not realistic right now for 100x scanning. The scans are too big and it takes too long. It took me 15 minutes to scan a blood smear at 40x this morning, and that's pretty standard. And so when we're scanning these slides, we're trying to find what's realistic. And so our residents need to get used to looking at what they're used to seeing. And so we picked a machine that we thought was a good resolution and we thought did a good job, but we didn't pick the one that could scan at 100x. Our machine doesn't even have that option. And we didn't pick the one that took the best pictures at the higher power, because once again, our machine doesn't have that option, but also it's not realistic. And so that was kind of the goal, was to get them used to seeing what they would be seeing.
Yeah, it goes along with that teaching philosophy that is practical. You know, it's towards informing your client and your referring mm-hmm. veterinarian. It's having them be a successful clinical pathologist mm-hmm. in whatever job they end up in mm-hmm. instead of necessarily for the boards or for the...
Yeah, we want them to have practice and we want them to have confidence. Part of that is having confidence using the equipment or a form of the equipment that they would be using when they're in practice.
How do you see the advances of digital pathology as directly affecting your job?
So, yeah, my job is now, I've got to get more comfortable with digital pathology. And I've actually worked for a company that used a remote microscope, which viewing the remote microscope is very similar to how you would view a digital slide. There's no more just scan through the entire slide, see where you find is interesting, because there's lag time. You have to move your slide, stop and wait, move it, stop and wait for things to actually come into focus. And so there's a little bit, it's a little different in how you evaluate a slide. And so having that experience kind of helps me with training my residents. It also kind of helps me to know that what I'm used to and what I was trained on, which was glass slides, is very different. And so this is also another place where I'm calling in the ACVP as a greater organization on familiarizing myself more with kind of the materials and the equipment, and making sure that I am including those digital scans into my educational kind of into the courses and the classes that we do. Kind of once we get it set up, because they're scanned, like I said, I just did my first scan today. So once we get further set up, we're going to actually be incorporating that more into rounds versus using essentially our camera scope. We'll likely scan our slides digitally and then actually like evaluate them on our system that we use. And so kind of just making sure that I'm incorporating that more long term, it would be great for that to be something that we could use for like emergency after hours cases, so that our residents don't, they can just be like radiologists that sit at home and look at things on their computer. That would be nice. And then I can do the same thing. Eventually, we're going to be looking at using it for storing slides as well. So instead of having to worry about what floor grade I have, so that I can put glass slides in there and store it, I now have to worry about how much server space do I have to store these slides. Am I going to be scanning? How many slides per each case am I going to be scanning? How much of that slide am I going to be scanning? Can I get away with just scanning a little corner of it because that takes up less digital space? Or do we need to be scanning the entire slide? And that's something that those questions haven't been answered yet. That's not something that's been really established yet. And I think that that's something that will come up. And I think the ACVP will be the driving force for us as far as what's the recommendations on storing slides and what's the recommendations on storing digital slides. And those are the conversations that are currently being had that we're just kind of waiting at the edges of our seat to figure out what can we do and how does this affect us as training institutions. I do anticipate eventually that's going to be part of our training. It's going to have to be, and it'll be mandated because that's what our residents are doing when they go out into quote unquote the real world.
Right. And probably for whatever governmental institutions become involved in this, there will need to be a standard, like you said. Like if you make a smear or someone takes an aspirate from a mass, puts it on a slide, and there's only one strip of cells, mm-hmm. do you need to scan the hole to see if there is one cell hanging out off the side? That's mm-hmm. an interesting question.
Yeah. And it's something that we don't know. And at this point, with our scanning, mostly since we're using it for educational purposes, we can get away with not scanning the entirety of every slide. We can scan the areas of interest and leave it be. But when you start talking about your diagnostic slides, that gets different. And I would be interested to know what the companies that use predominantly scanned slides, what they do, and how do they handle this situation? Because that's something that helps us with training our residents as far as getting used to scanning things.
That's fantastic. That's something that would have never thought about, you know. Well, thank you for teaching me so much about digital pathology in ClinPath.
Yeah. It's a new thing, and like we're all just kind of waiting to see where it goes.
And how great that it seems like you really are on part of the forefront of that. You know, you are taking those steps by implementing this with your trainees and for yourself.
Mm-hmm. So that's the goal.
I apologize if this is an ignorant question, but for what you do and now for using digital pathology, do you cover slip, like glue on cover slip every slide that you see?
So we don't. So predominantly, especially when we're using glass slides, nothing we look at is cover slipped, which made it an interesting challenge for digital cytology. And one of the things that we actually asked each company to do, because for those of you that are unaware, the 40X doesn't work unless if you use a cover slip. It is designed to be used with a cover slip. So that's why it's not always oil on the 40 that makes it fuzzy. Sometimes it's just you don't have a cover slip. So what we actually asked each of the companies that we demo to do was scan some of our slides without a cover slip, and then also scan them without a cover slip adhered. What we do is actually we will put a drop of immersion oil on the slide, drop a cover slip on that, and let the immersion oil kind of disperse and seal that on there without actually taking the time to glue it. Because one of the things that's really important in clinical pathology and cytology is the speed. And if we have to cover slip things, that adds days to a week or more, depending on how big of a cover slip you need and how fast your glue is going to set. So we need to be able to do this without actually cover slipping it. And so we found that even just adhering the cover slip with a little bit of immersion oil, so it's a very temporary setting, works for the scanning. And so that is how that's kind of our workaround, so that we don't have to cover slip everything, and we can still do things in the speed that's expected.
Fascinating. So about that speed, you talked about stat cases. How do stat cases work if they come in overnight?
Yeah, so we have our residents are on call It is actually the resident and the faculty that's on service that day is on call overnight. And so usually the residents are the ones that get called. They will field that. And we ask a lot of questions as far as, how is this actually changing what you're doing with your patient? Is this going to make a difference? Because there are some things that can wait. There's also some things that very much can't wait. And so our resident will ask the questions that we need to ask. They'll get more information on the case, and we'll find out exactly, has the sample already been taken? Where are they in that procedure? Maybe they've just scheduled an MRI and the CSF hasn't been collected yet, but we need to know when that's going to happen so that we can be there to process it. And so then after the resident has all of that information, they actually call the faculty back up and update us on the case and be like, okay, here's our ETA, here's where we're at with that. And then we'll kind of evaluate from there. But right now, without digital pathology, at the very least, our resident goes in and has to stain the slides, has to look at the slides and whatnot. Sometimes we can get away with getting pictures as the faculty, especially if it's like a septic abdomen or something, you get some nice pictures, and I can do that from home, but we're hoping that with this digital pathology, neither one of us actually has to come in. We can get some people that are trained to stain, and then we'll just load it on the scanner and hit go. And then we can actually log on and look at it, which would be really nice.
For those stat cases, is there a genre of disease or sample type that you see most are stat? And I'll give some examples to help, like infectious disease or CSF versus other?
So the predominant stat cases, we see two kinds, and some of them are during the day, and some of them, which are during the day policy, is we're actually even more strict on the stats during the day. Because if anybody submits a stat, that means that their sample goes to the top of the pile, which pushes everybody else's samples further back. And so we're trying to kind of protect the rest of the hospital as well. So you got to make sure that it really needs to be statted. During the day, we see a lot of intra-op samples. So they're in surgery on this patient. They've taken a sample and they are going to make a surgical decision based on what we see, whether it is neoplasia or if we see something that's actually septic. So intra-op, and then after hours, most of the stats that we see are actually like the patient presents with abdominal effusion or pleural effusion or something like that. And they're really just checking, is this septic? For those of you who are unaware, ClinPath is actually very bad at identifying bacteria. There's usually very few bacteria, a whole lot of other cells, and we're only looking at such a tiny little sample of those cells that if we find them, it's like finding a needle in a haystack. It's always very rewarding. But if we see a neutrophilic inflammation, we're going to say, you need to culture this, treat it like it's septic for the time being. And so that's kind of what they're going for and what they need from us. And so most of the stats we get in the middle of the night are for that reason. And so we don't see as many neoplasias after hours. But when we get those samples, we will prepare a direct smear, which is where we essentially take a drop of fluid, smear it like a blood smear. We will do a sediment preparation where we spin it down in a centrifuge, and then take that little bit of sediment, similar to how you do urine sediment. Pour off the fluid, take the sediment, smear it out like a blood smear. But then we also do a cytocentrifuge on every fluid where we put it into this special centrifuge that takes these special, we take slides and then we have these little filters and funnels on them. And it essentially like ultracentrifuges the samples and it puts all of the cells on a very small circle. And so we call it cytosplat because it splats out all the cells and it makes it easier to see. And so we will actually make all of those preparations and stain all of those preparations. And it's important for us to look at all of them because some things like the cytocentrifuge just in general, because it's so concentrated, if you have any sort of artifacts in there, it tends to show up a lot more. So we'll see a lot more like just junk that might be in the sample, whether it's like fibers or just amorphous stuff. If you see, you might be able to see the cells better, but if you're seeing things like erythrophagia, cytocentrifuge has been shown to activate macrophages enough to eat red blood cells. So we go back to our direct and we will actually look to see, okay, we're seeing erythrophagia here. Can I verify that it's actually happening on the direct? So can I be confident that this is hemorrhage versus an artifact? I do personally have a hard time believing that a macrophage could eat a leukocyte just from the cytocentrifuge. I feel like that takes a little bit more. But that being said, if I see that, I'm still going to verify it on the direct. And then sometimes your cytocentrifuge is like so jam-packed full of cells that you can't even see anything. but it's kind of hard to make them out when they're really balled up on the direct. And so then you go to the sediment and you look at it in between. And so it's really important that we make all of those so that we can do a full evaluation. And our residents are actually trained in how to make all of those so that after hours they can take care of that.
That's wonderful. And great diagnostic methods, both for the patient and for your residents to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to pivot and ask you a fun question.
All right.
Ready for it?
Mm-hmm.
How is your office decorated?
My office, I've actually had a student come in before and tell me that my office is more comfortable than the therapist's office, to which I responded, thank you. I'm not a therapist. I'm not qualified for this. I have a box of tissues and that's about as far as it goes. But my office is filled with things that I enjoy and things that remind me of why I like my work. So I have pictures of cool cytologic samples. I've got my little Trichodina, which is a former publication of mine. That's just a really cool, like, looking picture. It takes a great picture. Respiratory epithelial cells, which are my favorite. I also have done a little bit of a project. My COVID hobby is embroidery and cross stitch. And so I took it upon myself to cross-stitch these images of cells. And so I have my little embroideries of the cells as well as the pictures. I also have a lot of plants. I did find that when I moved into my office, there was a decent number of flies. And so my partner, Matt, got me some carnivorous plants, which are working. And it's super fun to watch them try to eat things. But so I've that as well as kind of other things that help me function. And some of that is like the lighting. There's a lot of blue fluorescent lighting at pretty much any major building anymore. And when I started working, from looking at the computer screen all day to being in that office, I was getting migraines. And so I actually got on Amazon, you can get these things that like magnet up to the lights that essentially change whether it's like changes from blue light to yellow light. So now I have a couple of lamps and I have those on there. So I have yellow light in my office and I have not gotten migraines since then. I also use blue light blocking glasses for my computer for that very same reason. It's a mixture of things that make my workspace productive for me. And I do encourage my residents to kind of have the same thing. And they actually, when we were talking about the lighting in my office and whatnot, they actually requested that I bring in some of the light blockers for the consulting office where they work. And so we put those up. That being said, if it's dark outside, it does make my office feel a lot darker, but that's what the lamps are for.
It's a trade-off.
But yeah, so it's kind of, I've got my wall of textbooks and of course my obligatory wall of like diplomas and whatnot. But I also have next to that the veterinarian's oath. In my undergrad, I actually was a certified veterinary technician. So I have the veterinary technician's oath up there as well. So I've got little crocheted things from some of my former colleagues that are fun and cell-based and plant-based and all of the things that I like. I also got a board that's my brain board where I put all of my projects on it so that I don't forget things, because that's terrifying to like just, I forget everything. So if I've got something that's working, then I put it on the board so that I know that it's in process and where it is in the process so that I can keep things straight. So it's a lot of functional, but then also things that just make me happy.
And that's how you get the best work environment, is mm-hmm. to find out what works for you.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you also for helping your residents to get that environment.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bias as an anatomic pathologist. Mm-hmm. Your office is absolutely beautiful. Your decorations, the books, everything. You don't have a microscope.
I don't have a microscope. And that was something that was kind of when I was first interviewing and talking about and like in talks to come work here, I noticed that they didn't have microscopes, and I was used to every pathologist having a microscope. And I was like, well, this is the microscope that I'd want. I'd want this one and I'd want these things for it. And this is what I need. And then talking to them about it, they're like, yeah, we don't really need it. We've got a nice setup in our ClinPath office. We've got a couple of scopes in there and a double headed scope, which is actually far more useful than a scope in my office would be. So I actually will go down there, and I'm really actually looking forward to having the digital pathology capabilities, because we can also use scan slides and whatnot. But when I'm on service, I look at slides in the consulting office, and that's like my working functional space for when I'm looking at slides, versus when I'm doing other things that are more organizational and for the courses and all of that in my office. Like, that's where I do that. So it's kind of more about like what workspace works best for what you're doing. I also know that one of my friends who works at a diagnostic lab reads only digital slides, and she was like, yeah, I was real worried when I didn't have a scope, but I don't miss it. And I can say the same thing. I don't miss not having immediate access to a scope, like just because of where the microscopes are located, it comes with a lot more collaboration because I can ask opinions and I can kind of see what everybody else's thoughts are if I need it. So, but yeah, I don't need a scope.
Well, that's all so wonderful. And I really thank you for the work that you've been accomplishing in adapting to help your residents to move towards digital and improve yourself so that you can help the future pathologists and veterinarians of the world. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for doing what you do. Thank you so much for talking to us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for letting me tell you a little bit about our program here at WSU.
Love it. Thank you all for listening.
A giant thank you to Dr. Mara Varville for sitting down with us and having a conversation.
And before we end out this segment, we want to send out a huge thanks. Your current hosts are primarily anatomic pathologists, and we recognize that we unintentionally view the world through this lens. In aligning with the missions of ACVP, we look to strengthen our collaborations with those in different subspecialties by partnering with two incredible clinical pathologists on writing questions for these interviews. So huge thank you to Dr. K. Worry Davis and Matthew Snexnader, who were generous enough to contribute to the questions for this podcast.
Listeners, you can find information on the Errors in Publication portal and a link to the portal itself at acvp.org/page/errors-in-publication.
You can listen to this podcast anywhere that you get your podcasts. As always, the contents of this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Veterinary Pathologists or the associated companies, institutions of those involved. This audio is property of the American College of Veterinary Pathologists. We appreciate you listening, and we look forward to our conversation.